You may proceed.
May it please the court. Danny Vaughn's crimes were not protected speech, and he has failed to establish that any part of this statute criminalizes a substantial amount of First Amendment activities or that the statute fails to give adequate notice of what conduct is prohibited. The trial court erred in dismissing these charges. My name is John Grantham. On behalf of the state of Missouri, I plan to briefly summarize the facts in the case before addressing each of the points in the same order as they are in the brief, unless the court directs me otherwise. On April 27th of last year, Danny Vaughn illegally entered the home of his ex-wife. He did so without her knowledge. He did so with a key that she didn't know that he had. In the 6 years since their divorce, he had been told several times not to return to that home. Danny Vaughn, after illegally entering her home, lay in wait until his unsuspecting wife came home and was terrified. When she opened the door to discover that the safety of her home had been violated by a man who had threatened to harm her in the past, Ms. Vaughn became terrified. She ran outside of her home and down the street, where she called the police. Vaughn's actions that day, taken together with the history of their relationship, proves that Vaughn knew that his wife would be surprised and terrified to find him lurking in her home. The state charged the defendant with second-degree burglary, alleging that he had remained in Ms. Vaughn's home for the purpose of committing a stalking, as set forth in subpart 6 of subsection 1 of section 565-090 of Missouri Revised Statutes. Less than 2 weeks after he broke into her home, Vaughn made a series of telephone calls to Mrs. Vaughn after he had been told not to call her again. For these acts, the state charged the defendant with stalking as set forth in subpart 5 of subsection 1 of 565-090 Revised Statutes of Missouri. The information alleged that defendant, it alleged that defendant made repeated telephone calls. The original information tracked the language of the statute before the 2008 revision. After, at Mr. Vaughn's hearing, at the hearing on his motion, the state amended the information to reflect the more current language of the statute and charged him with making repeated unwanted telephone calls. Now Mr. Vaughn wants to avoid the consequences of his actions by hiding behind the First Amendment, even though he's never claimed that any of his actions were protected speech. The facts of this case illustrate why, in the last few decades, the U.S. Supreme Court has curtailed the application of the overbreadth doctrine and also vagueness doctrine, really any facial challenge under the First Amendment. Under Article 3 of the Constitution, federal courts are limited to only exercising their power in actual cases and controversies, so as to avoid making constitutional doctrine on hypothetical situations. One aspect of the case and controversy requirement is that a party have standing, a fact that the state has conceded in this case, that Mr. Vaughn does have standing. One aspect of standing is that the person assert their own rights rather than the rights of third parties. And it is true that this is relaxed in First Amendment cases, so as to permit facial challenges rather than insisting on a litigant challenge a statute as being unconstitutional as applied to their own behavior. But courts have expressed an unease with prohibiting the application of statutes to protect people and to prohibit harmful and antisocial behavior at the request at the expense of letting those who have committed harmful acts go unpunished. The courts have limited the application of the overbreadth doctrine in several important ways that are set forth in the brief. But the bottom line is that the overbreadth doctrine, as the Supreme Court held, should be used sparingly and only as a last resort, as the court held in Broderick versus Oklahoma. With regard to subpart 6, and that is the part that reads, a person commits harassment when he, without good cause, engages in any other act with a purpose to frighten, intimidate, or cause emotional distress to another person. It starts off that way. I won't read the whole subsection. First, it should be noted that this court could read that subpart to not include any speech at all, but to include only conduct.
Are we required to read it that way in order to make it constitutional?
I don't believe so. I don't believe the court's required to. It's helpful. It sort of attenuates the application of the overbreadth doctrine. But even with regard to speech, the state is allowed to prescribe certain aspects of speech as long as it's circumscribed what forms of speech that is prescribed, that it's actually harmful and not speech that's protected by the First Amendment.
And does that provision do that? Is it sufficiently definite to to prescribe specific improper conduct or improper speech?
It does, and there are several things about the statute that limit it. First, right off at the beginning of the subpart, it requires that the act be done without good cause, and several jurisdictions have considered phrases like without good cause, like, you know, without a legitimate purpose, as a means of excluding behavior that might be, you know, not harmful or protected by the First Amendment. Not necessarily standing alone, but with other provisions that also limit the application of the statute. Secondly, but just to go back for just a moment, the other subparts of the statute, all the other subparts of the statute, prescribe some sort of conduct in some way, with the exception of this one, which prescribes only, which actually prescribes any other conduct. And so this court could read it to mean that because the other subsections mean specifically communication, this was meant to cover acts that are not communicative. Now, obviously, in some ways, the act is, these sort of acts would be intended to communicate things like fear or intimidation, but those are those are communications that are not protected under the First Amendment anyway. The statute also requires that the actor act with a specific intent, and this is a provision that's been held both to reduce the breadth of the statute and to decrease the vagueness and to put someone on notice. The reasoning being that someone's more likely on notice that their behavior is prohibited by law if they set forth to act with a malicious intent. When they set forth not to engage in some sort of artistic or journalistic or expressive behavior, but they intend at the very outset to disturb someone else's life, to put them in fear, to cause them to change their behavior out of that fear, or to disturb them, then they are already put on notice that their behavior is prescribed.
Now, the Kansas Supreme Court struck a similar provision in their statutes, saying that the words that were used by the Kansas legislature were vague, words such as alarms, annoys, harasses. Can you distinguish that case from what we have here in subsection 6?
The real problem word, as I see it, is annoys. Annoys, anytime annoys appears in statute, that was the big problem word in Coates versus Cincinnati, which is the U.S. Supreme Court, I think the most recent U.S. Supreme Court case on similar statutes. And they stress that, you know, what's annoying to one person is not annoying to another, and the undercurrent there seems to be that the state's interest in protecting you from annoyance is not that, it's not nearly as high as the state's interest to protect people from fear and to protect them from, you know, receiving substantial emotional distress or being intimidated, being forced to do things that they don't want to do out of threats. The state has a compelling interest in those sorts of situations to prescribe that conduct. And so, whereas that doesn't apply to annoy. And so once the word annoy or even perhaps alarm enters a statute, the courts get much more concerned and they require, I'm not sure that any of the cases have found enough limitations for a legislature to prescribe annoying conduct. Our statute doesn't prescribe annoying conduct. It prescribes only conduct that is, and that's largely because the word annoy is so subjective. Our statute, subpart 6 rather, prescribes conduct that's frightening, disturbing, or causes emotional distress, a word that's quite common in the law and used in other contexts. Subpart 5 has a very objective standard, whether or not the communication is unwanted. It's either wanted or it's not unwanted. It's not on the part of the recipient. That's not a term that's open to interpretation. The statute also, subpart 6 also requires that conduct be directed at a particular person, and the intent has to be towards that person, and the effect has to be towards that same person. The victim has to be the one who...
Is there some implication of good cause or some other limitation on 5 so knowingly makes repeated unwanted communication to another person? Because, as opposing counsel notes and the judge noted, there's many contexts in which someone may not want to hear bad news or information that's critical, and yet they may need to hear it repeatedly.
Well, I think in that context, the statute would prescribe that. If someone communicates, what's helpful is...
So I can't keep telling my daughter to do her homework? That's harassment? I mean, seriously, that's what they're saying. It would apply in that kind of situation. So what keeps it from applying to that kind of communication?
Well, I have two responses to that question. First, as the court has noted in...
I should note she does her homework.
In William versus Black, the court said that, the U.S. Supreme Court said that what's important is not necessarily that we can think of hypotheticals where the statute might be applied, but whether or not there's a substantial amount, whether this statute really doesn't prescribe very much harmful conduct and runs the risk of prescribing a lot. There's not necessarily that we need to be concerned at every turn that a prosecutor is going to use the statute improperly. Those sorts of concerns can be addressed with as-applied challenges on a case-by-case basis. In that situation, what's helpful is that the statute can be read to mean that the victim or the putative victim has to prescribe, has to say, I don't want any more communication at all. Not necessarily that I don't want communication on a particular subject. And this reading would be consistent with the legislative history. Before it was amended, the statute prescribed repeated unwanted telephone calls. And there was nothing in that, in the statute beforehand, that would suggest that the legislature intended to hand the victim the ability to make content-based, or the putative victim, to make content-based determinations about what subject matter they either wanted or they didn't want. Once they decided they didn't want communication with the person, they could communicate that, and then the person would be criminally liable. And so that in some ways places some limitations on the scenario that Your Honor presented. It also helps that in here the conduct in subpart 5 is also has to be directed at a particular person, because it has to be knowingly repeated and unwanted. So they have to know that it was repeated, and knowing that it was unwanted, the state would probably have to show that the victim actually communicated that communication was unwanted, and then the perpetrator would have to continue to engage in the behavior after knowing that. And so in order for that to happen, the communication would have to be directed.
Are there any other, you still have time for rebuttal. Are there any other questions? Thank you.
The state says that that subsection 5 has to be substantially overbroad, but that's the test, going to be the test only for subsection 6. Substantial overbreadth only has to be found if there's conduct at issue rather than speech. And subsection 5 criminalizes knowingly making repeated unwanted communication to another person, because that is directly implicates protect speech at all, and certainly implicates protected speech. This court would only have to find mere overbreadth to find that statute is overbroad.
Well, not just, I mean, not, it's the cases don't say, if you can think of any example.
They don't, and mere was my term, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'm sorry. However, substantial overbreadth is the test only if there is conduct involved. Now, in subsection 6, might be directed to conduct in the sense that it criminalizes any other act, but that is such a broad term that it encompasses, the act, that particular subsection was put in to deal with cyberbullying, which is a communicative act. It could criminalize picketing, it could criminalize flag burning. There are a lot of First Amendment protected acts that can be criminalized by that subsection.
Well, it does say without good cause, and those, since they're specifically protected by law, wouldn't that be good cause?
You know, there's cases, and we've cited in our brief, that say that simply putting in the words except for protected conduct is not sufficient to save the statute. One of the state's arguments has been that this court could sever some of the language in this statute, and that of course is in the vagueness discussion. But this court has declined to do that in the past in the Carpenter case, because when you look at this particular subsection, I think subsection 6 is the most problematic one. Any other act is such broad language that you cannot sever that action. You could sever the words, you could sever the word annoy if it appeared in there. The Attorney General is correct that the word annoy does not appear in there, but we've got frighten, intimidate, or cause emotional distress. And those languages, in the Kansas case, the court talked about this as a common sense determination of fundamental fairness. You have to look at these terms as to whether they give notice of the prohibitive conduct and whether there's arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement as a possibility. In this case, you have a case where Mr. Vaughn is charged with burglary with the intent to commit harassment for being in the house. The burglary exists because he is being charged with harassment and is being bootstrapped up from a trespass. In other words, one element is being used to show the other. That's the sort of arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement that can occur when you have this sort of vague statute.
Is there any question of fact that he entered the home with the purpose of frightening and intimidating her because he knew that, or question that there was sufficient, there's a basis for finding that he entered
with
that purpose?
Well, and this, of course, judges, is an appeal, state's appeal from a motion to dismiss, so the facts aren't fully fleshed out.
So at this point, that's not contested.
A facial challenge.
For current purposes only.
The judge in this case found this to be facially vague and overbroad. I've discussed in my brief some of the problems with a vagueness as applied challenge as well. That's a little harder to discuss hypothetically without the facts being fully fleshed out in an actual case. We do know what the prosecutor asserted at that motion to dismiss hearing, and it was that Mr. Vaughn was present in the house simply with the intent to scare Ms. Vaughn. In fact, he said, the prosecutor asserted, I can't charge this under any of these other subsections. This is the only one that it fits under. The statute was amended.
Counsel, what about, the charge is overbreadth and that it's too vague to understand what the person being charged is charged with. But doesn't the language in there that it must be purposeful, that the purpose to frighten, intimidate, or cause emotional distress eliminate that problem? Because the state would have to prove that the criminal defendant intended to do a bad act.
That's language that is very helpful in that subsection 6. That's actually the language that was taken out of subsection 5. The purpose to frighten or intimidate or cause emotional distress, I don't think the purpose language is vague, Your Honor, and we haven't challenged the purpose language itself as vague. What I think the vague terms in this statute are any other act. I think that's the real problem with that particular subsection. I think cause emotional distress is an issue, and I think a person of average sensibilities considering the age of such person is vague language also.
Yeah, but even as to the any other act, it still has to be with the purpose to frighten, intimidate, or cause emotional distress, doesn't it?
This court would have to find, and vagueness and overbreadth get so conflated in some of these cases that I find myself doing that this morning, discussing one when I intend to be discussing the other. But it's
how do the statutes define harassment? Do they include purpose and intent?
This particular subsection includes with the purpose to frighten, intimidate, or cause emotional distress, but the harassment statute itself no longer contains the term, contains a purpose term in the opening clause. The original statute that was amended had purpose of frightening or disturbing in the opening clause, and that was the statute that this court found to be constitutional in the Keating case in 81. But that's been taken out, and it's not in subsection 5 at all. Subsection 5 now simply has a knowing mental element, which is also a problem. And Judge Price, I don't think I got back to your question because I skipped on to something else. But I think the any other act language is what is vague.
Doesn't the any other act, it's assuming conduct as opposed to speech in that statute?
It can, Your Honor, but it can encompass communicative conduct.
It says communication, which presumably means some sort of speech, either protected or not, or any other act. So if all sorts of speech are within the realm of communication, then why wouldn't the any other act be limited in the context of that sentence to be conduct?
I think there's no question that a proper narrowly drawn statute could criminalize the conduct that the state is seeking to criminalize in this case. But the statute has to be narrowly drawn, has to be drawn with requisite narrow specificity in order to simply deal with that particular conduct. I think in that this statute is the any other act language that's problematic.
But I still want to go back. Even I understand okay. You're talking about any other act, but the very next words are with the purpose to. So don't the words with the purpose to sufficiently narrow that, because the state would have to prove that the defendant actually intended his acts to be those that would frighten, intimidate, or cause emotional distress. So it's not just any act. It's an act that I myself intend to frighten, intimidate, or cause emotional distress. Doesn't that remove the
We still have the problem of the words emotional, just cause emotional distress. In the Williams case out of Washington State, the court found that a threat to mental health was overbroad language as opposed to a threat to physical health. Now, Missouri statute covers threats to physical health in one of the other subsections. Emotional distress would be akin to that. I believe Mr. Grantham referred to this as having to cause substantial emotional distress, and I would point out that that language is not in there. It simply says cause emotional distress to any other person and cause such person to be emotionally distressed. I don't see why that's any different than the word annoy that has repeatedly been found to be vague in the context of these cases.
Annoying could be squeezing the toothpaste tube in the middle, but that doesn't necessarily cause emotional distress.
What some of the cases, Judge, have pointed out is that what's annoying to some people is not annoying to others, and it's got to be drawn. It's got to be drawn in order to not only implicate protected conduct, but to give a criminal defendant sufficient notice of what's prohibited.
Language includes an objective test, doesn't it? And such person's response to the act is one of a person of average sensibilities considering the age of the person?
That's right.
So what's the significance of that it is limited? It's not if I'm overly sensitive and I'm emotionally distressed by the toothpaste being squeezed, that it's an objective test. So how does that enter into the analysis?
It's relevant, Judge, but this statute includes both a subjective and an objective term. So we have to have a definition of emotional distress, and we do have to have that reasonable person standard in there. And that's something that's been held by other courts to save a statute. This one, ours says average sensibilities considering the age of such person. Again, I believe that was drafted for the cyberbullying example. It's different language than I've seen in any other of these other statutes.
Well, doesn't it try to cover it from every angle, though? It says you've got to intend to frighten or intimidate them or cause distress. They've got to actually be frightened, intimidated, or experience distress. And a reasonable person would be frightened, intimidated, or experience distress. So how else could they define it from everybody's point of view, objective and subjective, on both parts? How could there be confusion and without good cause?
Again, I think it's the arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement part of the vagueness challenge that's really a problem in this particular statute. And I just have a few more minutes. I would like to talk about sub 5 if the court. I think that whereas vagueness is a bigger problem with sub 6, overbreadth is a bigger problem with sub 5. This particular statute, the legislature took out the prefatory language with the purpose. The purpose language, there's no longer a purpose to frighten or disturb another. It's now simply knowingly making repeated unwanted communication to another person. This statute certainly criminalizes communication and not just conduct. And as the judge found in this case, there's a potentially huge universe of otherwise legitimate telephone calls at issue. The judge did use the example of a mother calling.
And to respond to my own example, there's another line of cases that give parents certain authority over their children, which would be an overlay here. But do you have a right to, if you're not in that kind of protected relationship, to continue calling and calling and calling someone? Or why can't the legislature criminalize that and make that harassment?
But this statute will cover political political calls as well. I think that's the real problem with it. there's no limitation in this particular statute to anything other than there does not have to be a purpose to harass in this particular subsection. There simply has to be knowing that the phone calls are unwanted. And it's no longer limited to telephone calling either. It's broadened. It's been broadened to any unwanted communication with a person. So it's not limited to telephoning someone in their home. It's not limited to, it will cover political speech on the street as well, simply as it's read. And that makes the statute overbroad.
It's restricted by, it's unwanted. So what makes, isn't that a significant restriction that you have to know that particular person doesn't want the communication?
You know, that one of the U.S. Supreme Court cases said that the First Amendment is not bothered by some of this conduct. You know, there has to be a protected class of cases that, you know, as a society, we just have to put up with some of this in order to protect those rights to free speech. In this situation, the legislature has written a section that is so broadly defined that it does implicate protected speech. I think taking out the purpose to frighten or disturb was a big problem with this subsection.
Is there any case dealing with comparable language about knowingly repeating unwanted communication?
I think the closest one is the Utah case I cited, that Provo City case. They found that their specific telephone harassment statute was overbroad, and it's actually written as telephoning, not just communication itself.
And did they say it implicated the First Amendment?
Yes.
But
yes,
haven't numerous other courts in other states upheld these types of harassment statutes?
You know, the cases are all over the board, and the state has cited the ones that go his way, and I've cited the ones that go my way, and there are a lot of different ones. I think Provo City is the closest to sub 5. I would also ask this court to take a close look at this Williams case. It's out of Washington State that talks about threats to mental health, not just threats to physical safety, and I think that one is closest to our sub 5 as well.
What causes the courts to split on this? Is there some fundamental difference in how they approach the issue, or what do you think causes some to see a First Amendment issue whereas others don't?
I really think that they're parsing this language in terms of what words are used. They're looking at some of the factors that both of us have cited to you all in our briefs in terms of the word annoy has been found to be problematic, whether there's a reasonable person standard, what the mental element is. And I hope there's so many different sub-issues to this that I hope the briefs have been helpful in parsing some of that out in a way I can't do in 15 minutes.
The briefs were very helpful, and thank you for your oral argument.
Thank you.
To return to the word annoy for a moment, I think the reason that courts are so bothered by that, the term annoy doesn't describe any particular act. It describes a reaction to an act. There is a universe of actions that one person or another might find annoying.
How about unwanted? Why isn't that just as vague?
Well, because the word unwanted is more an issue of someone being able to express the right to be free from communication and to be left alone. And so they can put someone on notice of whether that behavior is desired or not by saying, I don't want it or I do want it. And so that's an objective.
And how does that apply to political speech? Say if you're just on a public park and you're talking about people are expressing their views, you see people up on the soapboxes, you know, making their comments on religion and politics and so forth, would that be a violation of the statute if you stood there expressing your thoughts on today's issues and someone said, shut up, basically, and you continued talking?
Well, the court could construe it to mean that it really does need to be directed to a particular person, because since it needs to be knowing and unwanted, that it needs to be directed at a particular person, not that someone could give a speech in public.
But as long as people say, be quiet, please quit doing that, then it would violate it?
I think the statute could be read that it wouldn't apply that way, because the speech, the ongoing repeated nature of the speech is not is not demonstrating a continuity of purpose to continue to want to make communication to a particular person.
But annoying is I could be in a car and I'm talking to someone and they take a cell phone call. I find that to be very annoying. But they're not intending any emotional distress to me. They're just getting a cell phone call while they're driving and I'm in the car while I'm talking to them. That's annoying, but it's not emotional distress.
It's not, and I think, but if Your Honor expressed that you did not want the, you no longer wanted the communication, then it would fall under the statute. And perhaps under the old statute, the presumption, in a lot of cases, it ended up being a sort of presumption that if you continue to make phone calls after being told to stop, that you must be doing it for some reason to frighten or intimidate.
This says communication. Is communication defined?
It's not in the statute, no.
So communication could mean use of electronic media?
Right.
Like a TV commercial.
And if we can trust...
No, I mean, it could be a TV commercial?
It could be.
What about the 25th political TV commercial in beginning of November? I mean, wouldn't that be something that knowingly makes repeated unwanted communication to another?
Well, I suppose a prosecutor would have a difficult time proving that communication was unwanted if the person continued to leave the television
on. It'd almost be judicial notice that some of the there would be a large body of people. I mean, I'm kind of humorous, but kind of not. A large body of people would react negatively to a particular party's ads, and they are repeatedly made, and they're knowingly made, and it wouldn't be hard for anybody to understand that a Democrat wouldn't want to see a Republican commercial or vice versa. Would that be outlawed by this statute in some way?
I think the court's response at this point, I think, should be one of hesitation, though, to throw out the entire statute because it does prescribe a good deal of antisocial behavior.
Following up to Judge Price's question, I see on TV all the time these people saying, come to us for your legal services. You might have suffered a stroke or you might do this and that. If I call their 88 number and say, I don't want to hear your commercial anymore, it's offensive. They're not going to stop. Can I cause them to stop? Because they're knowingly now advertising something I don't want to hear.
I think a prosecutor would have a difficult case to prove that someone didn't want a communication if they left their television set on.
Because I think you were starting to say they have a choice whether to listen or not there quite easily. Is that part of the unwanted is you have to indicate?
Well, exactly. And we allow juries to make decisions.
This is the point of, the constitutional no-call cases, they do have exemptions for political speech and so forth, the no-call list. But surely the legislature doesn't have to put those same sorts of First Amendment protections in criminal statutes, do they? I mean, when we talk about arbitrary enforcement, we don't really have very many prosecutors filing harassment charges against people running for political office here, do we?
That's correct. Then there are avenues. I mean, if those happen, then an as-applied challenge would certainly be appropriate.
But it's the chilling effect that's important here, because it doesn't matter whether you're prosecuted or not. If people don't make the communications because they fear you will, then it violates the First Amendment.
That is the concern. But in the few cases,
political context and religious context.
That is a concern. But in the few cases where the statute could be applied to protected speech, those could also be addressed. By way of a declaratory
judgment. How do we interpret this to only apply to not protected speech when it doesn't mention anything?
Well, to the extent that it prescribes speech that is unwanted and the U.S. Supreme Court has found that the person does not have a right to continue to make communication to someone that doesn't want that communication.
Very complicated word, unwanted.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Thank you very much.